Certainly so. Certainly so. All right, if you'd open up to Matthew chapter 9, you may remember from last week as we covered through the first 8 verses and even the tail end of chapter 8, of seeing Jesus come back to his own city, come back to Capernaum, and to see the situation at hand with these religious leaders in terms of the scribes and the Pharisees, the teachers of the law, the Jews literally coming from every village in Galilee, as well as coming up from Judea and Jerusalem. We looked at that description of the crowd over in Luke chapter 5, verse 17. And as you see these things unfold, what Jesus is putting in front of them is so drastically different than anything they had ever experienced or seen before. And so here they are seeing Jesus have the authority to forgive sin. And then you come here to verse 9 and notice how this continues. As Jesus went on from there, and from there being where he was in Capernaum, he says he saw a man called Matthew sitting in the tax collector's booth, and he said to him, "Follow me." And he got up and followed him. And of course, you realize this is the writer of Matthew. This is his own story. And he doesn't give you all these details about himself, which is something. Because typically whenever people come to their own part of the story, that's where they really want to elaborate on, here's what it was like for me, here's why I responded when he came, here's where I was when it happened, and here's what changed within me and in my life and all these things. If you notice, Matthew wants nothing to do with that. And the Spirit of God wasn't going to use Matthew in part of that story for really this. Other than the fact of going, I'm going to drop this in line at this point, and I want you to kind of notice something of this too. From here on out, when you read through the stories and you start seeing the Gospel of Matthew mentioned, that the apostles are gathered around or his disciples are gathered around, realize that Matthew is present. He is seeing these things with his own eyes, which tells you it's a lot different whenever you hear someone, I don't know if you ever do this, you have a couple of people who say, well, you know, I heard that this is the case, or I heard that that was the case, and then finally you get to talk to somebody who was there, and it kind of trims all the fat off of the story of going, well, that's not really the case. This is truly what took place. And so here it is with Matthew, and it just says he's sitting in a tax collector's booth. And Jesus comes up to him and says, "Follow me." And you may even have an exclamation point. And the response was, and he got up and followed him. And notice, even Matthew doesn't say, "and I got up," but just says, "and he." It leaves it at that, kind of writing in the third person. He says, and he got up and followed him. And you know there has to be more to these stories. We've seen other accounts of other apostles where it'll just give you a story like this, and then another gospel account will tell you a bigger story that took place that led to these things coming along. So here, what we're about to read in verses 10 through 13 and beyond, this is Matthew's real first introduction to Jesus in terms of now being his disciple. Not just hearing about him, but now here's Jesus, come follow me, inviting Matthew in and saying, follow me. And this is what he does. And I want you to kind of notice how this continues. Verse 10. Then it happened that as Jesus was reclining at the table in the house, behold, many tax collectors and sinners came and were dining with Jesus and his disciples. Which tells you, all of a sudden, Matthew, who's a tax collector, is there. And in typical fashion, tax collectors were not thought highly of. Just in general, it doesn't mean all of them were crooks. Don't take that thought. But they just kind of saw them as, they're just going to take some of the money. Okay, and I'd rather have it for myself. Then it happened. I mean, here's Jesus just reclining in the house, eating a meal, sharing it together, and who else is there dining with him? Tax collectors and sinners. And he brings up these two specific groups. So what does Matthew notice right off the bat? Who does Jesus invite to to be with him? Who's he willing to sit with and dine with? Sinners and tax collectors. And being a tax collector himself, where most people want nothing to do with you, I mean, I kind of think of it in this way. I don't know if you've had this experience or not, just in Cole County, where the county assessor comes up and they knock on your door and they go, "Do you mind if I come in?" And your next question is, "Do I have an option?" Right? Because you know, if they come in and they see something that's improved, what's going to happen to your taxes? They're probably going to go up. And so you realize, you know, I've actually seen this one. Because, of course, after they came to our house, they just keep on moving down the street. Somebody who's out in the yard doing something, and they see that, and they hear it, and all of a sudden you see them go inside, and they just lock everything down. And you see them knock on the next door. Nobody's coming to the door for some reason. Huh? But you just kind of get that general feeling in those situations. And going, here he is, the people that seemingly no one wanted to have any time together with. And realize this, when you see the term sinner used in the gospel accounts, a lot of times in Jewish thinking, it was a Jew that was not practicing Judaism, was considered to be a sinner. Now, we know other illustrations of this or other definitions as well in terms of going, a sinner is someone who's committed sin, but someone who's not practicing what is righteous is what's really seen as being a sinner. And so oftentimes we want to think in terms of ourselves going, we're sinners, but you go, in Christ, is that really who we are? Have we been forgiven by the authority of Jesus? Are we continuing in not responding to God anymore? I hope not. I hope we're coming to him out of faith to serve him. And if he's made us well, if he's taken away all the guilt and the sin, what does it leave us as? Redeemed. Paid for in full. Here's Matthew to come in and to see people like himself and to see sinners that are there. And if you've ever been in a situation where people come into the room and they'll talk to everybody except for you, how does that make you feel? Uneasy, terrible, awful? An insider, you know, an outsider in terms of not part of the group. Is that what we do sometimes? Sometimes you go around and you'll talk to people, and then all of a sudden here's somebody who's out there kind of on their own island, and they never even get addressed. And to go, that's how Matthew kind of fits into this situation in the city. Nobody wants to talk to him. He's a tax collector. And then to come into this place, and maybe it's even Matthew's own house. It doesn't bring out the detail. But Jesus is there reclining, and there's many tax collectors there and a bunch of sinners. And if you remember, coming to verse 11, you know the people that were there in the first 8 verses. There were scribes and Pharisees and people like that there. Verse 11, when the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, now just stop there for a second. When they saw what was going on, who should they have talked to? Why are they not willing to? You know, it kind of leaves it up there in the air. It doesn't really tell you why, does it? But we kind of know what we think. And he says, when the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, why is your teacher eating with the tax collectors and sinners? What if one of those disciples is Matthew himself? How would that question hit you? Why is your teacher eating with tax collectors and sinners? And for Matthew, that would come across in a different way, wouldn't it? And going, because he's marvelous. Because he's compassionate. Because he's kind. But even if he's not addressing this to Matthew, even if it's just one of the other disciples. Say, why does your teacher eat with these type of people? And notice very quickly who does not answer the question. And notice who steps in to answer. Verse 12. But when Jesus heard this, he said, it is not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. Now, here's Jesus stepping in. You want to know why I'm here with these tax collectors and sinners? He says, because it's those that are sick that need a physician. And you can imagine, he says, you know, it's not those who are healthy who need a physician. Which you can kind of go, I want you to realize this too. Pharisees, why are you here? Now, hearing this, I don't think they went, oh yeah, we're sick like them too. I doubt they had that thought at all. But when you see what's at hand, he says, it's not those who are healthy who need a physician. And I know this flies in the face of our everyday medical world now. I mean, has anybody ever been to the doctor for a well visit? Yeah, got one tomorrow. I mean, I can tell you with my medical situation, I have well visits four times a year, which is so different. And maybe that's why things are so hard to get appointments. But you start to look through it and go, in this point in time, you didn't call for the doctor unless you were sick. And so here he was, and he makes this statement about healthy, sick. He says, you don't call for a physician. And at the very same time, you realize what's going on in the minds and hearts of people if we start to become partial. I'm going to talk to these people. I'm not going to talk to those people. Is that a healthy situation or is that a sick situation? It's not almost like it. It is, right? So whenever you pull that into focus here, when we become people who say, you know what, I don't talk to that person. I do talk to this person. Who am I like in this story? I'm like the Pharisees. How are the Pharisees doing spiritually? Spiritually dead. Remember what Jesus said about the Pharisees as a whole? Whitewashed tomb. He says, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will not enter into the kingdom of heaven. Now, does this have anything to do with, well, their response isn't always right. Is this about them? Or is this about us? It's about us. Now, I want you to notice something as he goes forward. He brings up this great quotation from the Old Testament, which tells you how aware Jesus is of what's going on. Verse 13. But go and learn what this means. Now, just stop at that statement first. What do you figure out just from that statement? They have a lot to learn. Need to put into practice what they do read. He says, you're going to have to actually go and learn this. Which tells you, you haven't learned it yet, and you're going to have to carry it with you. And then here comes this quote from the Old Testament minor prophet. He says, I desire compassion and not sacrifice. For I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners. He sets these two things kind of on the end of the spectrum. He says, I desire compassion. What are these Pharisees not willing to have with the tax collectors and the sinners? Compassion. And if you read through all the gospel accounts and if you see a statement where it says, and Jesus felt compassion for them, you can always keep reading the next verse or two and Jesus is about to respond to do something. Compassion is not a feeling. Compassion is the trigger to action. For them, they don't even have a trigger, is what he's telling them. He says, you don't even have compassion. You look at these people over here and you go, I don't like them. I don't like what they do for a living. I don't like the way they act. Because isn't that what a sinner is? They're not acting godly. And at the same time of saying, I'm not going to offer anything to them. He says, I desire compassion and not sacrifice. If you've ever used or been motivated from the phrase, it's better to ask forgiveness than permission, I encourage you to read this. He says, I'd rather have compassion than have a sacrifice. He says, we need to do it right, even if it's harder. And then notice the statement here. He says, I did not come to call the righteous. Isn't that something? I didn't come to call the righteous. Now, who do you think they are in this picture? Do the Pharisees see themselves as the sinner or as the righteous? The righteous. And they're looking down upon the tax collectors and sinners and going, I mean, even in their question, asking the disciples, why does your teacher eat with such people? And you imagine, Jesus didn't let the disciples be the ones who were going to control the teaching in that moment. Susan. Yeah, something they should have known. And if you think about the tie together with that, of this quotation out of Hosea, and I want us to go back. Look at Hosea chapter 6. Right after Daniel. I was hoping it'd be raining whenever we covered this. I think you'll see why if we can get there. Hosea chapter 6. If you think about what Hosea is about in general, I'm sure you're very aware of the story, but God calls Hosea, one of his own prophets, and he tells him, I want you to go and I want you to marry a prostitute. And Hosea does exactly what he's been told to do. And he goes and marries a prostitute by the name of Gomer. G-O-M-E-R. And they have three children together. And then she basically, we would say in our terms, falls out of love with Hosea. He has given her everything that she needs to bring her out of the lifestyle that she was in, provided for her, and instead, she goes back to her harlotry. And in doing that, it even goes so far that men will no longer pay to be with her, and it flips around where she pays them for this service. And it's in this moment God uses to teach Hosea a lesson. He says, this is the way Israel has treated me. I gave them everything they needed. I provided all that was more than enough in abundance. And yet Israel has gone after all these foreign gods and is no longer dedicated to me. In the midst of this story comes Hosea chapter 6. And I want to spend a little bit of time here in Hosea. Look at verse 1. He says, come, let us return to the Lord, for he has torn us, but he will heal us. He has wounded us, but he will bandage us. And you go, how did Israel get in the situation they were in? Disobedience. And sure enough, did things get better for Israel or worse? A lot worse. And yet, what was God still willing to do? I'll heal you. I'll tie up your wounds. He says, I'll take care of you. I'll heal you up. Then, here comes a prophecy, verse 2. He will revive us after 2 days. He will raise us up on the third day, that we may live before Him. Who's that a prophecy about? Jesus and His resurrection. I mean, do you realize in John chapter 2, I mean, you're at the very beginning of the ministry of Jesus, and He goes in and He cleanses the temple and He tells them, tear this thing down, I'm going to rebuild it in 3 days. What does He already know? He knows He's going to be raised from the dead. And this is in John 2, it's the very beginning of His ministry and teaching. He already knows what God's going to do with Him. I wonder if he had been reading Hosea. Because we know, well, by the time we get to Matthew 9, he's going to quote out of Hosea. So, notice how this continues on in Hosea 6. He says, He will revive us after 2 days. He will raise us up on the third day, that we may live before Him. Verse 3. So let us know, let us press on to know the Lord. His going forth is as certain as the dawn, and He will come to us like the rain, like the spring rain watering the earth. He says, the rain comes and it goes, doesn't it? You realize here, he says, let's press on to know the Lord. Let's press. And if you notice, Lord is written in all capital letters. So what's this about? Come to know the covenant God and His promises. He says, His going forth is as certain as the dawn. I mean, do you have any doubt that if there's a tomorrow, that there'll be a dawn? This happens every day. He says, and He will come to us like the rain. Doesn't rain bring about refreshing? And then He brings up specifically the spring rain. What does the spring rain cause to happen? Oh, everything is revitalized. It really turns on. What's amazing to me, he's talking about 2 and 3 days. You see a flower or a plant that has been dried out over no matter how long of a period of time, within reason. You water it for just 2 or 3 days, and what can you tell the difference? It responds that quickly. If it has any life left in it. Then, verse 4. What shall I do with you, O Ephraim? What shall I do with you, O Judah? Ephraim and Judah doing okay? Not at all. They need to be healed, right? They need to be revived. They need the spring rain because they've gone through the death of winter, if you want to put it kind of in the proverbial sense. But notice how verse 4 continues. For your loyalty is like a morning cloud and like the dew which goes away early. How good are they on loyalty? They're about as good as the dew on a hot summer day, right? It comes and it's gone pretty quick. There is loyal, I mean, you're as loyal to God as a morning cloud that just whisks away and brings no rain with it. He says, even like the dew which goes away early. Verse 5. Therefore I have hewn them in pieces by the prophets. I have slain them by the words of my mouth, and the judgments on you are like the light that goes forth. He says, and because their loyalty is so minimal, what's happened? What did God bring? A judgment. He says, whenever there's no loyalty to me, and specifically notice in verse 5, he says, I have slain them by the words of my mouth. Whenever God established His covenant with Israel in the days of Moses, that covenant not only carried with it blessings, it also carried cursings. If you will honor me, what would you get? A blessing. If you turn away from me to do things your own way, what will you get? A cursing. How is Ephraim and Judah doing? They're cursed. And it's by their own choice. Because they've chosen. The Word of God's not enough for us anymore. We need something different than that. The Word of God is not sufficient to take care of all my needs and all my troubles. When that becomes the reasoning and the thinking, what is God going to do? Bring judgment. When there's no loyalty to His Word, He says, here comes judgment. Now, notice how this continues. He makes a statement here. He says, and the judgments, notice it's plural, not just one. He says, and the judgments on you are like the light that goes forth. How quickly does that happen? When you think about lightning, I mean, try and time it next time. You're not fast enough to even time it. He says, and the judgments will come quickly when they come. Then, verse 6, this is where that quotation comes from that Jesus quotes in Matthew chapter 9. For I delight in loyalty rather than sacrifice. He says, what if you were actually to keep my word and to be loyal? Now, in Matthew 9, it uses the word compassion. Because whenever you're loyal to God, you know what you're going to have? You'll have compassion. You won't be able to see somebody like Matthew who's sitting in a tax collector booth all by himself, isolated, nobody really wants anything to do with him, and go, it's okay, I'll just let him stay there. Just come follow me. And if you notice, Matthew doesn't hesitate. He doesn't say, well, you know, I've got a pretty good gig going here. He goes, I'm here. And then Matthew's first introduction to being with Jesus is having these Pharisees who are supposed to know the law come in and say, why does your teacher eat with sinners and tax collectors? Why would he eat with such low-down scum like you? He didn't say it that way, I know. But you realize, here's where Jesus gives this statement of saying, look, it's not those who are healthy who need a physician. It's those who are sick. He says, go and learn what I've told you. He says, I delight in loyalty rather than sacrifice. He says, you can offer up sacrifices like burnt offerings and say, God, I give you all of me, and yet you will not honor my word. He says, and what will you get as the outcome? Judgments that come as quick as light or lightning. Then verse 6, and in the knowledge of God rather than burnt offering. He says, I delight in loyalty. I delight in the knowledge of God. Would you come to know me? Then I want you to pick up on a couple more verses before we go back and make a specific application in Matthew 9. But verse 7, he says, but like Abraham, they have transgressed the covenant. There they have dealt treacherously against me. What was the covenant that Adam had with God? Just think about it. What was the covenant? It doesn't call it a covenant back in Genesis chapter 2 and 3, but it calls it a covenant here. What was the covenant that Adam had with God? Says, do not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. You can eat from any other tree in the garden. And when you think about that percentage-wise, how many good options were there compared to the one bad option? A whole garden full of them. All these great options would have been blessings from God to eat and to strive with God, together with Him, and yet to go, nope, we're not going to go according to the covenant. Wasn't that the problem with Ephraim and Judah? Wasn't that the problem with Israel? And you realize, all because we're going against what God commands. He says, they've dealt treacherously against me. What are the Pharisees doing? Are they honoring the old covenant? No. And how's Jesus going to deal with them? He says, I'm going to talk to you. And I'm going to tell you straight. And he brings the truth right in front of them. Then look at verse 8. He says, Gilead is a city of wrongdoers, tracked with bloody footprints. He says, the city of Gilead? He says, man, it's just full of wrongdoers. You mean like sinners? Exactly. He says, and you can even, I mean, can you even imagine this? This is quite an image that Hosea is putting in front, or God's giving to Hosea. It is so full of wrongdoing that you can follow the footprints in town and take it to the next one. Bloody footprint. Then verse 9. And as raiders wait for a man, so a band of priests murder on the way to Shechem. Surely they have committed crime. Let's see. Who's going to be the group that's really going to be at the heart of putting Jesus to death? The religious leaders. The chief priests. Oh, this is what happens when you don't care about doing things the Lord's way. You're just going to use the outer facade. Right? Now, when you see this situation and these things, come back over to Matthew chapter 9. I think you can understand why Jesus brings this up. Because when Jesus quotes this kind of passage, I mean, he opens these things up to go, and we do the same thing in our own language. We can use one phrase and it really stands for a whole story, right? You know, we see somebody who falls down a hill and they break a bone and you kind of go, Jack and Jill, right? And we know the story that goes with it, right? Well, here's where Jesus is saying, go and learn what this means. I desire compassion and not sacrifice. And it would be enough for these Pharisees to go, oh, he's talking about the prophet of Hosea. That's right. But here's the problem. Pharisees looked at the book of Hosea like, that's right. We're Hosea, and we're looking for a bunch of Gomers. What did they not realize? They are Gomer because they had no loyalty to God. They had no loyalty to His Word. To think, we need something other than God's Word to really get us through this or to make these things happen. Or you go, oh, is our God so insufficient that He can't take care of us? And have we become so unloving that we can't even sit down and eat with sinners and tax collectors without questioning the teacher? You see what they're doing, and Jesus puts it right in front of them to go, if you have a heart, you can go and you can learn this. The question is the heart there? So he says, for I did not come to call the righteous but sinners. Who is he calling in that moment? A bunch of Pharisees who need to realize they were sinners. A bunch of chief priests who are going to go on to incite this plan for Jesus to die. And yet, what did Jesus already know? You can come up with all the plans you want and you can kill me, but there's one thing you can't stop. My Father's going to bring me back on the third day. And that's what made Jesus so compassionate. Because he trusted the promises of God. And he knew them. And he says, but you need to go learn compassion. You need to learn loyalty. He says, and when you do, it'll change everything. It won't be about going to offer a sacrifice. It'll be about being a living sacrifice, which is Romans 12. So you see, for Matthew, if you've ever been in this situation where you've been treated like an outsider, and then somebody who is respected comes and takes you by the hand and says, come and go with me. What did you learn? Compassion. And compassion is such a gift that whenever it's shown to us, it changes us. Because it makes us want to start to look for who are the people who are being outcasts. And then you go and you offer them compassion. Say, come. Let's do these things together. Let's look at God's Word together. Let's dive into what loyalty to God really looks like. And you realize the Pharisees had none of that. They were really good at thinking, we're Hosea. And Jesus saying, you're Gomer. Are you humble enough to see it? I'm calling sinners. Do you realize that's you? I don't know that they did. At the same time, maybe some of them got it later. Karen. Right. And you see, they come in on their own terms, and guess what? They're going to leave on God's terms. Because what are they walking away with? Opportunities have been put in front. They don't want to hear it. And they stay right where they are spiritually if they don't. Then, you see why this section starts in verse 9 with Matthew being called. I mean, you think about how personal this story is to Matthew in his situation. Then, look at verse 14. So, there's the Pharisees that had a question. Now the disciples of John have a question. Verse 14. Then the disciples of John came to him, asking, why do we and the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast? You ever been hungry long enough and you start to look around and go, you know, this is not a pleasurable experience. We've noticed that we fast, and we've even noticed that the Pharisees fast. And you might be thinking of the story that Jesus tells about the Pharisee and the publican who are praying to God, completely different contrast between the two. The Pharisee says, you know, I even fast twice a week. I mean, that was kind of in the history. It's not really specifically in Scripture what days it was, but typically Monday and Thursday was the Pharisees' day to fast. They fasted 2 days out of the week. And it wasn't the intermittent fasting that they talk about today. But here they were. And so the disciples of John take notice. Like, how come your disciples are different? And if you remember, John was all about teaching his disciples who should they go to follow. You need to go to the one who's greater than me. Jesus is the one you need to follow. And they come and they're like, this is different. This is not the exact same. And so they have a question for Jesus, and don't think necessarily they're asking this question out of like a huffy puffy spirit. They're just, sometimes you have questions, you go, I don't understand this. Could you just help me understand this? And so they ask the question, why do we and the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast? Verse 15. Jesus said to them, the attendants of the bridegroom cannot mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them, can they? But the days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast. Now, we don't typically call them a bridegroom anymore. We just call them a groom. And so, this is an aspect that has completely changed between the first century and the present day. In the first century, the wedding was all centered around the groom. Present day, it's all around who? The bride. Now, so you realize, be careful about trying to read into this something that you go, well, yeah, whenever we do. Be careful. It was all about the groom because the groom was going to provide for the wife. She typically was not going to work outside of the home. There's a few exceptions you can read to that. Sometimes the husband and wife would be in business together in terms of making a living, like you think of terms of Aquila and Priscilla. Yeah, I was afraid I was going to come up with the wrong names there. But I always do that. But Aquila and Priscilla, both tent makers, you realize there's some exceptions there, but going, this was about a man giving away his daughter to be married and that she would be taken care of by this man that she was marrying. You wanted to make sure best possible place. If you want a parallel, why does the church have anything of value to it at all? It's because of who we're married to. It's because of Jesus. Now, don't take that to the present day marriages. I'm not saying, well, you're only something if you got a good husband. That's not the parallel I'm looking at. But for spiritually speaking, the only reason the church has any value whatsoever is because of its tie to Jesus, the bridegroom. And what does he provide? Every spiritual blessing. You can't find any outside of him. And to turn away from his word, why? So here's the situation that Jesus brings up. How come your disciples don't fast? And he says, the attendants of the bridegroom cannot mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them, can they? He says, in terms of being away, mourning tied to fasting is the idea. So the attendants of the bridegroom cannot mourn or fast as long as the bridegroom is with them, can they? It's like, why would you go to a big celebration and go, oh, by the way, we're going to fast? I mean, I think about how many families wish that this was the case for their, you know, in terms of going, there's a lot of food we're buying for this wedding. How about we just declare a fast for this one and save us a lot of money? But you see what Jesus is saying. But the days will come when the bridegroom is taken away. So this is going to be a time whenever Jesus is no longer walking the earth. He says, and then they will fast. And you can read about those stories in Acts where the disciples did fast after Jesus ascended to the right hand of God. If you remember whenever Paul and Silas are being chosen to go out on one of the missionary journeys, the congregation there in Antioch is fasting, seeing who God is going to put forward. And by the Spirit, Paul and Silas are selected to go. And you realize, why are they fasting? Because Jesus is no longer there to give specific direction. Here we're going to rely on the Word of God. We're going to rely on walking by the Spirit and realize fasting, like we've already looked at in Matthew chapter 6, is about an intensified prayer. It's an appeal to God. No guarantee that, okay, I'll get a yes if I do this. And if you remember even Jesus, there were times where casting out unclean spirits or demons, and Jesus told the disciples, this one doesn't come out except by prayer and fasting. There's coming a time when you will fast. And you realize, had Jesus fasted in his life? Certainly. I mean, 40 days and 40 nights out in the wilderness. You see what's going on. And he came out of there in the power of the Spirit, is the way Luke talks about it. So, verse 16, he's going to use two illustrations. But no one puts a patch of unshrunk cloth on an old garment, for the patch pulls away from the garment and a worse tear results. Have you ever made that mistake where you went to the fabric store, you bought fabric, you're going to repair a hole, and then about the time you get finished sewing it up, you go, oh no, this wasn't pre-shrunk fabric. Oh, how did I let myself make this mistake? And then all of a sudden, you know, well, if I want to do this right, I might as well just get the seam ripper out and start pulling this patch off. Because if I go throw it into the washing machine, eventually it was already weak to begin with. Now it's just going to tear even further. I think we get that pretty easy. He says, and the patch pulls away from the garment and the worst tear results. He says, you don't do that. And keep in mind, what is Jesus coming to do? He's going to fulfill the old covenant. What else is he going to do? He's going to establish a new covenant through his death, burial, and resurrection. Then, verse 17. And if you notice in verse 16, he says, for the patch pulls away from the garment and a worse tear results. Does it get better or worse? It gets worse. He says, if my disciples are fasting while I'm here, he's like, they're missing it altogether. Because if you want to be in the presence of God, I'm right here. You don't have to fast to gain my attention. Verse 17. Nor do people put new wine into old wineskins. Otherwise, the wineskins burst and the wine pours out and the wineskins are ruined. But they put new wine into fresh wineskins and both are preserved. Now, it depends on how much you know about the aging processes of wine. But for them, they literally had animal skins is what they used. And they crafted them into some kind of container. And in doing that, you would add, you know, the fresh grape juice. You would add the fermentation in terms of some yeast and perhaps some other things. And then you would cork it up and seal it up. And in doing that, over the course of time, that yeast counteracts what's going on in the grape juice, and it brings about an expansion because of the gas that's let off. And in doing that, if you had an old wineskin, well, the wineskins, when they're new, after they go through that process, have expanded and have gone further. And if you want to think, this is not an exact parallel, but if you think about blowing up a balloon really, really big, and then going, and after the process, it's not like the leather then all of a sudden goes, okay, we can shrink back down. After it's already been used, if you try to refill it again, he says, and then it's going to expand again, what's going to happen to the wineskin? It's going to burst. And what's going to happen to your contents? They're going to be spilled and lost, right? I mean, I'm going to go out on a limb here. If you've ever spilled something, maybe it's something that you're going to drink, whether it be water or lemonade or whatever, and you spilled it on the floor, have any of you ever taken a rag, sopped up the liquid, and then wrung it back out in the glass to drink it anyway? Okay, good. I was safe. And you realize, once it's spilled, you're not going to reuse it. Right? Here's the thing. These Pharisees, yeah, these Pharisees were taking the old covenant, and rather than coming to the new covenant, they wanted to just refill the old and keep things the same. But what is Jesus saying? You'll burst the skin and you'll lose the contents too. There is nothing gained in this. Now, here's the unique aspect. Who is the new wine? Jesus is. Jesus is the new wine. And you realize, here he is. He's going to have to fulfill the old covenant before he can make the new covenant. And in being a perfect sacrifice, that's what he's completed. And it's going to completely rupture the way that they thought about things. And you also notice within this, of seeing those things together, of saying, if you try to put what's new onto the old, you'll make it even worse. That's what the end of verse 16 is about. And a worse tear result. Jesus even told the Pharisees later, he says, you go out and you go here, there, all over the earth to make a convert, and you make him twice the son of hell as yourself. What's he saying? You're not learning anything. You got all these great links to ruin it all. And so, here's Jesus in talking with the disciples of John and saying, look, there's no need to fast right now. There's no need. I'm right here. But whenever I leave, you'll fast again. And that'll be fine. And you realize that's what we see examples of in Acts chapter 13. It's what we see in the disciples there. And realize you're not going to read any stories about the disciples of Jesus fasting during the time that Jesus is on the earth. Not even one. And so, here it was. You can also understand for John, he was so concerned about doing things right. And John was a descendant of a priest, you know. His father, Zacharias, was a priest. His mother was actually a descendant of Aaron, way back in Moses' day. And to go, here's John who wanted to make sure he did everything according to what was right. He was willing to fast and even taught his disciples to fast. But there's someone coming who's greater than me. And you won't need to fast with him. And that's what Jesus is putting forward about who he is, about what he's going to change in terms of the old covenant to fulfill it and then to begin anew. And don't try and pour the new into the old, because you'll rupture everything. And how many times nowadays do people try to do that? I'm amazed at how many religious groups work off of so many things that are just purely Old Testament things and not seeing the fulfillment of Jesus and not seeing what he truly desires. And you can understand why Jesus makes statements like, I desire compassion and not sacrifice. He says, where's the loyalty? Where's the compassion? And where's the earnest desire for my word and to hold? He says, otherwise, everything gets ruined. And you see this point at hand. Now, any questions? You're like, clear as mud. And to realize, don't be just a spring rain. Keep going. All right. Well, plan to come back next week, and we'll start in verse 18. Thank you.